Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Rulak Toledano and Scott Veazey, authors of Martha Wright Ambrose, 1914 to 2000, The Rediscovery of a Southern Regional Artist. We'll also hear from Ethan Brown, author of Murder in the Bayou, Who Killed the Women Known as the Jeff Davis Eight. I am so pleased to welcome these two guests to The Reading Life. Rulak Toledano has written many books in the years since she graduated from Newcomb College, and she's an established authority on Southern art and architecture. She's curated exhibits at the Louisiana State Museum and the New Orleans Museum of Art, and she is the author of The National Trust Guide to New Orleans, a must-have for anyone who loves New Orleans architecture, and a pattern book of New Orleans architecture. Scott Veazey is an award-winning renovator of beautiful homes, a graduate of LSU. They've collaborated on a gorgeous new book, Martha Wright Ambrose, 1914 to 2000, The Rediscovery of a Southern Regional Artist. So welcome to The Reading Life, Rulak.
Thank you.
You too, Scott.
Thank you much.
So, Scott, for you, this book is personal in a deep kind of way, the best kind of way. So, tell us what it was like to know Martha and to have her in your life for such a long time.
Well, I've known her since I was a child. Her brother lived next door to my parents, so she was always around. And I got to know her better when I was a teenager. She was amazingly smart, very well read, up with current events, and appeared a little eccentric to most people because of her lifestyle choices. She was big into reincarnation, transcendental meditation, and she was a vegetarian. And I guess you would say Martha was New Age before there was such a thing, yes. And she also had her animals, which made her stand out. She had about 30 or 40 cats and dogs at the house most of the time. People were constantly bringing animals by that they didn't want, and she took them all in.
Now, was she the first artist you ever knew?
Yes, she was.
That makes such a difference in a person's life, doesn't it?
It really does. You know, we would see her down the street, and she would have art classes in her yard, and it just looked intriguing. And, we'd get to see the artwork.
Now, Rulak, this was a really accidental, serendipitous kind of thing, because you didn't know her work. And the way this whole project got started is so interesting.
It was a lot of fun. I was with the Art Institute of Chicago board members, taking them around in New Orleans, and they were in a state of shock, having seen the French Quarter in Uptown. I said, that's nothing. Wait till you see Faubourg Tremé and Scott Veazey's house. And we went to 1231 Marais, knocked on the door, and Scott answered the door. I've never met Rulak Toledano, but I have read her books on architecture and have therefore renovated 75 buildings according to her advice in this book. And this 1231 Marais is one of them. And we walked in and I said, forget about the house. Whose paintings are those? What are those paintings? Those are not Clarence Millet. Those aren't the Woodward brothers. Newt Helner? His wife? No, they're not Boyd Crews. What are they? Well, when he said the name, I said, who's that? I could not believe that I was looking at 85 wonderful paintings, and in one instant I could see how important they were, because besides her ability as a painter, this is the first person to introduce us to the Acadiana, to South Louisiana, the bayous, the small towns, the shrimp boats, the fishermen. And this entire PhD was right before me along the wall. And since my writing is mostly about regionalism, I was in a state of total ecstasy.
Well, who wouldn't be? I mean, you've got the beautiful art, you've got the beautiful house. So how did her work get lost? How is it that we didn't know more about her?
She did not need to sell her paintings. And I suppose that most painters are shaking all over by the time they finish a work of art in hopes that they will sell it so they'll have something to eat. You always hear of the starving artist. And we know that had her husband not died, she might not have been able to do all of those things. But she was very much in love with Jack Ambrose, whom she had met at the Art Students League in New York City, where she was fortunate enough to be able to study in the 1940s with important artists like Robert Brackman, who was actually from the Ukraine, a Russian, I believe, like Raphael Sawyer, who also influenced her. So while she is a regional Southern painter, she knew about world art and the importance of place. And it's sort of like Moses, Raphael Sawyer. His brother said that without art, we would have no civilization because it describes and expresses people, their likes, and their tastes. And without this record, the next generation, even though they have never seen the paintings, they are influenced by them because art envelops us.
Now, one of the things I love in this book is the way you match up paintings with photographs of these locations.
I said to Scott, oh my gosh, I can recognize that. It's on Burgundy Street, isn't it? Why don't you get a photographer and go find out where these paintings were painted and match them up?
I contacted Eddie Marroquin, who was one of our photographers, and we went out early one Saturday morning. We took 15 paintings and identified the locations and were able to take some really great photos. The impact of that is really strong when you see them side by side. You can see what a good artist she was. From a preservationist standpoint, you can see that the buildings are virtually untouched. These paintings were done in the 1970s and 80s. So it's nice to see that, you know, we have a Vieux Carré Commission and a Historic District Landmark Commission protecting these structures.
Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting, I think. Didn't you write about seeing her burn some paintings?
Yes. When I was about 19 or 20 years old, I went to her house and she had a huge fire in the yard and she is cleaning out a storage area and throwing paintings into the fire. And I said, what are you doing? These are great. And she said, oh, no, they're not very good. So I asked if I could have several, and she pulled a few that she thought were okay, and I took them. But I was shocked. She was so critical of herself and her work.
Well, so think about what we've lost. That's terrible.
Yeah.
But, oh. But describe her work, you know, because this is radio and we can't show a picture. I think the light in her work is so typical of New Orleans. I mean, it is realistic in many ways. She does a lot of landscapes. She does some wonderful portraits, too.
She was a representational artist throughout her life, painted in the realist tradition, taught her students the traditional art methods. She wanted them to learn that. And in her painting, it comes through. I mean, she really captures what she saw throughout Louisiana, whether it was architecture or landscapes, street scenes. A lot of paintings were done along waterways, bayous, and a number of things on the lakefront that are no longer there. So she captured a lot of this while it was still there.
It was interesting to me. She never had a smiling portrait. She did these wonderful portraits, but no one was ever laughing or smiling. Even her mother, who was a lovely, lovely lady, her parents, no one was ever smiling. And this turned me off at first. Martha Ambrose, I'm thinking, is she depressed or something? But no, she was simply determined to paint and paint day and night. And much of it had to do with the fact that her beloved husband, who was born in 1921 in New York, and she had met at the Art Students League, I believe, died in a terrible car wreck in 1961. They had no children, and she simply took care of herself by painting day and night and teaching painting. And she was a caring woman, you think, looking at the paintings, which are, to my mind, rather impersonal, that perhaps she was a selfish person, just wanting to paint and paint. But no, she taught painting, and she taught painting at DePaul's Institute. And to the children who otherwise would not have ever been introduced to painting. She did lots of public works.
Mm-hmm. The portraits that Ruloc's referring to and that is sort of expressionless look came from one of her teachers, Henry Henchy, who was at the Cape School of Art in Provincetown. And he was a student of Charles Hawthorne. Hawthorne had difficulty painting expression. So it was his form, and it passed down through Henchy to Martha. I don't find the paintings to look unhappy, but they are rather expressionless. It is a style. It's interesting looking.
They are very interesting looking. You do wonder what these people are thinking. So this must have been just a really incredible time for artists in New Orleans. The Arts and Crafts Club was so important. She was in the thick of all that.
She was in the thick of all that, but I'm a graduate of Newcomb Art School. And when I found out she had nothing to do with Newcomb Art School, I was so amazed. So at first I thought, oh, the poor girl was poverty-stricken because it cost a lot of money to go to Newcomb Art School. But that was not it at all. She was in another world with the Arts and Crafts Club and Clarence Millay. The Woodward brothers, who did teach at Newcomb, were active in all other realms, realizing that Newcomb is limited to the girls that go there. And Boyd Cruz, she was close to Boyd, who of course is so active, or was so active, in the development of the historic New Orleans collection. And really, she was a feature in bringing the recognition of regionalism to New Orleans. But again, the historic New Orleans collection, Martha Ambrose, who is that? But I think it's not because she wasn't a fine painter, but because she was self-sufficient and just painted and painted and had nothing to do with promoting her paintings. Now her first cousin did that.
Now, Scott, you found a lot of these paintings when you were working on her house.
Yes, I purchased the house in 2003. I owned it for about 6 weeks and went into the garage and made the discovery. There was no electricity in the garage. It was very damp, and realized that there were several hundred paintings, not just by Martha, but her students, people she studied with, the really important artists that she was able to study with around the country, and works by her husband.
Wow. Right, what a feeling.
Yeah, it gave me goosebumps. But my second feeling was, oh my God, I've got to get them out of this garage. This is not a safe place.
And that's an enormous responsibility after that.
It's been interesting curating all these years.
You have certainly learned about the restoration of fine art, both watercolors and oils. Martha started out as an oil painter, but she had a lung condition relative to the turpentine, apparently. And after that time, she was a watercolorist and took it very seriously and studied particularly the most important watercolor painters that she could find, Edgar Whitney and others at Cape Cod, and had them brought to New Orleans because Martha not only painted, but she taught painting and took lessons her whole life. It was an all-encompassing thing for her. She just didn't go into a studio and get carried away with herself and her brushes. She participated in every aspect of New Orleans life. She was on the board of the Delgado Museum, and she won a prize out there for the most important work of the year, A Woman in White, I believe. Mm-hmm. And her paintings of her, is it her mother, those beautiful paintings, portraits of her mother who was Belgian?
Yes.
Well, I think people are going to fall in love with her. I'm a little bit in love with her myself right now. It's a beautiful book, you all. We've been talking with Ruloc Toledano and Scott Feasey, authors of Martha Wright Ambrose, 1914 to 2000, The Rediscovery of a Southern Regional Artist. You can meet them Sunday, September 25th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Martha, my dear, you have always been inspiration, please be good to me, Martha, my love. Don't forget me, Martha, my dear.
New Orleans writer Ethan Brown often takes us on a walk on the wild side in his nonfiction, telling terrible truths along the way. He's the author of Queens Reign Supreme, Snitch, and Shake the Devil Off. Today, we'll be talking about his fourth book, Murder in the Bayou, Who Killed the Women, known as the Jeff Davis Eight. Ethan Brown, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Now, this is a story of eight murders that took place between 2005 and 2009 in Jennings, Louisiana. And these were particularly brutal murders.
Right.
So what made you decide there was a story here for you?
Right. So the origin story of my interest in this case goes back to the summer of 2011. I had befriended a private investigator in the Jennings area who at one point had been retained by victims' families to look into the case. And essentially I went out there at his invitation to have a look at the case. And I went out there with no story assigned, no book in mind, nothing other than just interest in this case. And I spent about a week in Jeff Davis Parish. Jennings is the parish seat of Jeff Davis Parish. And just meeting people, doing a little bit of research at the courthouse, but mostly just meeting people via the private investigator. And one evening, we were meeting folks in South Jennings. And South Jennings is the part of town where all eight of the victims were from. And we met a sort of hobbled drug dealer who had been shot several months earlier but survived, nicknamed Bowlegs. And he got the nickname because of the shooting. So he was an interesting character. He was in the drug scene in South Jennings, and he dated two of the Jeff Davis Eight victims. Met him very briefly, and I remember it very well. The sun was setting as I met him, and he sort of hobbled over to meet us. And we then went on our way for the evening, me and the private investigator. I went back to my hotel. The next morning, very early, I got a call from the private investigator informing me that Bowlegs had been murdered, which was, in my many years of doing this kind of work, a first. I had never met someone who was murdered a few hours later. And certainly in Jeff Davis Parish, which is 30,000 people in the entire parish, and Jennings itself, which is about 10,000 people, the notion that somebody that I had just met would be murdered in such a small area was pretty shocking. So I then went out to the crime scene early that morning and met the PI out there. And the crime scene was Bowlegs' house in South Jennings. He was murdered inside of his own house. And it was completely unsecured. There's no crime scene tape. There were a number of individuals walking in and out of the crime scene and carrying pieces of furniture and other items out of the crime scene. And I'd certainly never seen anything like this anywhere. And that day, I spoke to a number of more people in the area, including former law enforcement, and I told them about that story, about that morning of being at the crime scene and seeing it unsecured, and their response was a laugh and then, "Welcome to Jeff Davis Parish. We're sure you've never seen anything like this in your life." And I said, "Yeah, you know, you're right. I never have seen anything like this in my life." And that's really the basis for my interest in this case.
Meanwhile, writerly light bulbs are going off
right
all over the place,
Something's not right in Jeff Davis Parish. There are eight unsolved homicides. There's incredibly shoddy slash non-existent crime scene work at a murder scene of a man who was connected to the eight. So this was pretty stunning to me. So at that point, I pitched a piece about the Jeff Davis Eight to GQ. I had a fantastic editor there named Mark Lotto. We then spent 2 years on and off working on this story for GQ. Much of that time was spent with me doing tons of Public Records Act requests. In the fall of 2013, though, about 2 years or so after we had begun working on it, I began to get worried that there was no light at the end of the tunnel on the piece. And very interestingly, I happened to see a very brief, maybe 10-second teaser that HBO had released for True Detective Season 1. And I was floored. It was based in Erath, Louisiana, which is about 40 miles from Jeff Davis Parish. It was about unsolved homicides. It was about sex work. It was about all of the things that this case was about. I became sort of frenzied at the idea that the show is going to premiere in January of 2014. And this piece that I had might not run. My editor got a job offer to run some editorial operations over at Medium, which was then sort of a new website. And we got the piece up and running on Medium in January of 2014 at the nearly precise time that True Detective premiered.
Wow. Well, tell us about the women. Okay. Tell us about these eight women.
All eight women were from the South Side of Jennings. The South Side is working class, working poor, and then the totally unemployed. Mm-hmm. So the women were all from the South Side. There were six white women, two African-American women. That comprises the eight. Most, if not all of the women, struggled with mental health problems. They struggled with substance abuse, extreme poverty. And they all got sucked into a very heady world of sex and drug trafficking in Jennings from the late 90s to the mid to late 2000s.
You know, it's one of those things where you think, it doesn't happen here, it can't happen here.
Yeah.
And it does. Human trafficking is a very real problem in Louisiana. And what you've done is uncover this incredible conspiracy to kind of keep these women in their place.
Right. And I think it's interesting. So there's sort of multiple layers to the sex work they were engaging in Jennings. So one layer is they were impoverished. So they would engage in sex work for food or for little bits of money, right? Yeah. Another layer is, and this is according to law enforcement's own witnesses in this case, not my witnesses, they would engage in sex work to get released from jail. They would engage in sex work to get charges against them dropped. And when I say that, I should be more specific and say, you know, the allegations coming from these law enforcement witnesses are that these eight women would have, for example, sex with the parish warden to get out of jail, sex with specific cops to have charges dropped.
And you were warned off this story, Ethan.
Oh, yeah. From the beginning, I was, you know, I'll never forget it. I believe it was in the summer of 2012 when the GQ piece was assigned, and I was out there, and the ninth victim was Nicole Guillory. Her mother, Barbara, specifically told me, I'm laughing just because it's so dark, you know, I don't want to pick up a newspaper and see your name in it.
Right.
You know, and that was memorable, specifically coming after Barbara had told me that prior to her death, her daughter Nicole had said that the police were heavily involved in the murders. So yeah, I was warned off of doing this story a number of times, and that was one of them.
Well, if you want a book that'll give you nightmares, this is the one, I can testify truthfully. We've been talking with Ethan Brown, whose new book is Murder in the Bayou, Who Killed the Women Known as the Jeff Davis Eight. You can meet him Wednesday, September 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Ethan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Restaurateur T. Martin discusses and signs her book, Miss Ella of Commander's Palace, with writer John Pope, Tuesday, September 20th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Ethan Brown, discusses and signs Murder in the Bayou, Who Killed the Women Known as the Jeff Davis Eight, Wednesday, September 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Franz Helwig, American cut glass collector, discusses the American Brilliant Period, 1876 to 1916, at the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library General Meeting Wednesday, September 21st, at 10 a.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And just a reminder, the Friends have their big book sale coming up October 13th through 16th at the Pontchartrain Center in Kenner. New Orleans Harbor Police Chief Robert Sterling Hecker signs The Accidental Vigilante, Wednesday, September 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet Stacey Ann Balkin, author of Jackalope Girl Learns to Speak, and novelist Kevin Kilroy, author of The Escapees, are the featured readers at the Bloodjet Poetry Series Wednesday, September 21st at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Novelist Adam Jones signs Fate Ball, Thursday, September 22nd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild discusses and signs Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, Thursday, September 22nd at 6 at Octavia Books. The Latin American Library at Tulane University hosts its 12th annual open house Friday, September 23rd, from 1 to 4 on the 4th floor, Howard Tilton Library. The event features a book sale, an exhibit of recent acquisitions, and a gallery talk by visiting Colombian photographer Vicky Ospina. Novelist Ron Fisher signs Mid-City Errands, Saturday, September 24th from noon to 2 at Kitchen Witch Books. As part of One Book, One New Orleans, there will be a Louisiana Books to Prisoners book drive, Saturday, September 24th from 1 to 3 at Second Line Brewing, 433 North Bernadotte Street. 100,000 Poets for Change, a worldwide movement for peace, justice, cultural exchange, and ecological sustainability, takes place this weekend. 100,000 Poets for Change North Shore takes place Friday, September 23rd from 5 to 8 at St. John's Coffee House on East Boston in Covington. 100,000 Poets for Change New Orleans takes place Saturday, September 24th from 3 to 6 at Community Book Center. Check out the 100,000 Poets for Change New Orleans Facebook page. NOLA Paracon, a half-day literary festival featuring local writers and editors, takes place Saturday, September 24th starting at 9:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Featured speakers include Diana Rowland, Don Chartier, Gillian Zane, Alexandria Weiss, Eva Van Rel, Charlotte Parker, Andy Reynolds, Elise Arden, Lila Felix, Eden Butler, and Jennifer Dyer. Today's guests, Rulak Toledano and Scott Feezy, discuss and sign their book Martha Wright Ambrose, 1914 to 2000, The Rediscovery of a Southern Regional Artist, Sunday, September 25th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Poets Rodney Jones, author of Kingdom of the Instant and Salvation Blues, and Kathleen Balma read from their work Sunday, September 25th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. The Pirates Alley Faulkner Society celebrates its 25th anniversary of literary life with an event Sunday, September 25th. To become a member and join in the celebration, email Falkhouse, F-A-U-L-K, house at AOL.com. Whitney Stewart discusses and signs Feldpost, The War Letters of Friedrich Rainer Niemann, Tuesday, September 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jim Smith Jr. discusses and signs The No Excuse Guide to Success, No Matter What Your Boss or Life Throws at You, Tuesday, September 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And don't forget, Contraflow, that great gathering for science fiction and fantasy fans, takes place September 30th through October 2nd at the New Orleans Airport Hilton in Kenner. For information, go to contraflowscifi.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.